Does anyone have anything to bitch about so far? Things going smoothly? Okay, cool. There's plenty of time. We got up to slide 3, and the photograph here, or the box of the photograph, represents an ecosystem, as we described it before in the hierarchy of biological organization. Is this enough light if I turn this off, too? You want some on? Okay, cool. This is an ecosystem. It doesn't matter what specific ecosystem. The general point here that's trying to be indicated by the arrows is that for any given ecosystem, there is a throughput of energy, by which I mean energy enters an ecosystem from outside the ecosystem, and within the ecosystem, energy will be transformed and transferred, but then eventually energy leaves the ecosystem as well. So it goes, energy travels through an ecosystem. Now, the difference between transformation and transfer with respect to energy is that transformation refers to changing energy into a different form of energy. For instance, it enters as sunlight, as you see here. That's how it comes into the ecosystem. But it can get turned into chemical energy and the food produced by the plants, for instance. That's transformation. It eventually is transformed into heat. There's no arrow shown going out here, but it would be a red out arrow for heat. And transfer of energy refers to movement of energy from one object to another. And that's just in general how energy behaves with respect to ecosystems. On the other hand, matter, as opposed to energy, matter, stuff made out of matter, objects, materials, more or less stay within an ecosystem. It's not perfect. There's some leakage. But for the most part, materials stay within the ecosystem and just get recycled within the ecosystem, like the molecules shown here. That's the cycling of chemical nutrients. Okay, let's go to 4. This kind of is a continuation. We see sunlight coming in. That's one form of energy. It gets transformed into the chemical energy of food, which plants make, and then plants don't make the food for us animals. They make it for themselves, so they feed themselves. But thankfully for us, we're able to eat that stuff too. Anyway, there's all kinds of energy transformations. It's not just a single step. But eventually, there is a release of heat from the ecosystem. And heat is energy. But you can think of it as, in a sense, waste energy, meaning that it's not energy that can be put to useful work. So there's nothing we can do about that, and I'll have much more to say about that in the third unit when we really focus on energy. But that's the general scheme of things. Now, in 5, this example using the skeleton of birds illustrates the concept of, well, if you want to summarize it in a phrase that's often used, it would be form fits function. What that really means is that there is a close relationship between structure and function when you look at the structures within organisms, like the bone of the bird, and what it actually does, how it works. There is a close relationship. Things are the way they are because that works, is really what it boils down to. And the reason it gets to be that way is because of something we talked about last time. What is it that Darwin is famous for? Natural selection. The mechanism by which evolution can lead reliably through generations to increased adaptation. increased fitness of the population, the individuals in a population. So there's thousands and thousands of examples of that. Anytime you look at nature, you see examples of evolution by natural selection. This is just one particular example. It's nothing really important about this example, but let me just explain what I mean by this example. When you saw into a bird bone, like you see in the photograph, you'll notice that they are mostly space. They are called pneumatized bones, which means air-filled. Same prefix as in pneumatic, which means air-driven. And this is for good reason. This has evolved randomly, but the reason it was selected for by natural selection is because this happened to work well. Now, birds kind of have a reputation of being fragile things that you have to be really careful with, but that's really not so true. Birds fly, most of them do at least, most species do, and flying is something that a skeleton to withstand flying has to be really strong in order to do. There's a lot of forces applied to the skeleton when the wings flap. So the skeleton has to be really strong. Well, you can make a skeleton if you're designing things, and that's not how natural selection works. But if you were designing it as an engineer and you had no limits, you could make a skeleton plenty strong by using really dense material and using a lot of it, right? The skeleton wouldn't break. But what would be the problem with that if you were trying to design a bird? It would be too heavy to get off the ground. The skeleton would be plenty strong, just like you could make an airplane out of solid lead. It's not going to get off the ground. So if you think about it from a design aspect, which is, like I said, not what happens in nature, but it's instructive to think about it this way. If I give you the task of producing a bone, which is basically a long cylindrical shaped thing, and I want you to make it strong, but you have limitations. I say you can use only this much material. It has to have there's a maximum mass, in other words, that you have to stay within. Well, you could make a solid rod, right? If you make a solid rod, you're going to use up all of your material pretty quickly because of the fact that it's solid. In other words, a rod of a given mass is going to have a smaller diameter. And if you instead, I should kind of draw this as 3D, if instead you say, well, I'm going to not make it solid, instead of making a rod, I'm going to make a hollow cylinder, a tube. Well, then you can make a much wider diameter cylinder, right? But it still has the same mass as the narrower rod. And just think about this in terms of metal. Think about a coat hanger, which is a rod, a metal rod. Doesn't weigh very much, but because of that small diameter, it's pretty easy to bend, right? But if you have an equally light metal cylinder that's wide, it's not going to be nearly as easy to bend. And that's because if you bend this thing, either one of these two, let's say you bend it to this angle, bending this is going to cause on one side compression of material, and it's going to cause expansion of material on the other side, right? You're going to stretch it on this side, and you're going to compress it on this side. But notice that the bigger the diameter is, the greater the amount of compression there has to be for the same angle, and the greater the stretch. Is that clear? And so that's why a wide tube resists being bent. And this is why, for instance, in modern bicycles have much bigger tubes than they used to have. They don't have to be heavy. They just have to be strong. And so this happens randomly. Natural selection doesn't cause things to happen. The reason it's called natural selection is because what is selected, and it's really not active selection, what the selection refers to is that accidents that happen to work are the ones that get passed on to the next generation. So the variation in individuals happens because of random mutation. That random mutation is what gives different individuals of a population different traits, like whether you have a not as hollow a bone or a more hollow bone. And the individuals that randomly have traits that happen to work in the conditions in which they live, those are what are selected for. That's what natural selection is referring to. And that results, after many generations, this natural selection process results in there being a close relationship between form and function. It's no accident, in other words, that bird bones are shaped the way they are, because that's what works. Okay, now to six. Are you able to see the board when I write it without light? Okay. In six, we see another dichotomy. I gave you a dichotomy last time, right? What was that dichotomy? Yes, a dichotomy with respect to cell number. There's any given organism is either unicellular or multicellular. This is a different dichotomy, but it still involves cells, like the whole term does, really. The whole course is cell biology. But the dichotomy here has to do with what kind of cell an organism has. And it's a dichotomy, so there's two possibilities, which is why we see two cells here, a representative of each of the two types. The bigger one is the kind of cell that we have, and it is called a eukaryotic cell. Now you can use that as an adjective, eukaryotic, or we can use a similar word, the noun form of this, to describe the organism that has this type of cell, which would be a eukaryote. So we are eukaryotes. But linguistically, this karyo part of the word means kernel or core, kernel with a K, the center of something. Well, that's generally what it means, but with respect to cells, what it's referring to specifically is the conspicuous purple center of this colorized version of the big cell, which is the nucleus, the cell nucleus. And the EU prefix means true or good. So linguistically, eukaryotic means having a true nucleus. Now, a true nucleus has a specific definition. A nucleus is an example, just one example, of an organelle. Remember, we talked about organelles as being a level within the hierarchy of biological organization. So there's all kinds of different organelles. Nucleus is just one of them. But more specifically than that, a nucleus is a membrane-bounded organelle. And since that's the first time I've said that phrase, let me tell you that there are two phrases that sound very similar that don't mean the same thing, and they're sometimes misused. Membrane-bounded is one phrase, and that's different from membrane bound. Let me explain linguistically what the difference. Bounded is a past tense, right? As you'd expect, something that ends in ED. To bound means to form a boundary. Like the United States, for instance, is bounded by the Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean. All right, so that's what bounded refers to. Bound by itself, as another word, is itself a past tense of bind, which means to connect. Right, so something that is bound to something is connected to it. Something that is bounded by something is surrounded by it. And that's the difference. A nucleus is a membrane-bounded organelle because it's an organelle that is surrounded by or bounded by its own membrane. That's what's required for it to be a true nucleus. Speaking of membranes, every cell has at least one membrane, because it wouldn't be a cell without the membrane that defines it. The defining membrane for any given cell is the boundary between the cell itself and everything else in the world. That outer membrane is called the plasma membrane. Some books call it the cell membrane, but it's the plasma membrane is the more proper word. So every cell that's ever existed has, by definition of being a cell, a plasma membrane. That membrane is distinct, though, in a eukaryotic cell from the membrane, the separate membrane that surrounds just the nucleus within the cell. And that's what makes this a true nucleus. And therefore, this cell, the big one, is an example of a eukaryotic cell. The smaller cell, and there's exceptions to how big cells are, but in general, the other type within the dichotomy of cell, they're generally only about one-tenth as big in each of the three dimensions. So volumetrically, they would be a thousandth of it. But anyway, the second category is called a prokaryotic cell. And therefore, we can call an organism having such a cell a prokaryote. Now, the pro prefix of this word means before. And the reason that makes sense is because linguistically, prokaryotic means before the nucleus. Before meaning these were the original cells. The first cells that were created and that were the ancestors to all of us, all not just humans, all living things, those original cells didn't have a nucleus. The nucleus evolved later, came into existence later. So these cells are named for the fact that they were on the scene before the nucleus was. They're ancient cells. There was a couple billion years of life history in which that was the only kind of cell. The nucleus is a relatively new device. But anyway, that's why cells without a true nucleus are called a prokaryotic cell. That's the basis of the term. But even though prokaryotic means that the cell does not have a nucleus and eukaryotic means that it does, that's not the only difference between the two. That's just the basis for the distinction in the naming. A prokaryotic cell, like I just got done saying, doesn't have a nucleus, but it also doesn't have any other kind of membrane-bounded organelle. Which, if you think about what I've been talking about, means that a prokaryotic cell has only one membrane. The membrane that all cells have to have to be cells, which is the plasma membrane. A eukaryotic cell, on the other hand, not only has a membrane-bounded organelle called the nucleus, that's the basis for what being called eukaryotic, but it also has other membrane-bounded organelles in addition to the nucleus. And that makes a big difference with respect to how things happen within these two types of cells. Because a prokaryotic cell is more or less like a bag. It has just one boundary, right? One membrane. And everything collectively within that plasma membrane is one compartment. A prokaryotic cell has just one compartment. And all of that stuff within that one compartment collectively is called the cytoplasm, which means, linguistically, cell stuff. Cyte means cell. The study of cells is cytology. For a eukaryotic cell, like our own, there is compartmentalization within the cell. It is not just one compartment. And that's because of the fact that it has these other membranes that form membrane-bounded organelles. There is a cytoplasm for a eukaryotic cell as well, but it's not everything within the cell. The cytoplasm, which is this kind of ecru-colored background, the cytoplasm for a eukaryotic cell is everything that's in the cell but outside of all the membrane-bounded organelles within that cell. So the stuff inside the nucleus is its own compartment, and that stuff is not cytoplasm. It's called nucleoplasm, the stuff of the nucleus. But the light brown is the cytoplasm here. We'll talk about the nucleus in greater detail and the other important membrane-bounded organelles that these eukaryotic cells also have in a separate chapter. All right, 7. One of the things I want to say that I'm reminded to say by looking at this figure is that I haven't said anything about cell theory. Cell theory says, among the things that cell theory says, is that cells come from pre-existing cells. Another way of saying that is that cells don't just pop into existence. Cells are created because cells before them create the new cells, generally by splitting. Now, if you think about this logically, that can't have always been true, right? Cells can't always have come from pre-existing cells. There had to have been first cells that did not come from pre-existing cells. And that's true. But that happened under conditions of early Earth, which is nothing like the conditions on Earth now. This was the beginning of life history, which is not the entire history of Earth. There's almost a billion years of Earth early history before there was any life. And conditions were really, really hot. We'll talk more about that later as well. But eventually conditions favored greater and greater collection of organization until there were eventually cells. So it is true, and we'll talk more about the creation of the original cells later, it is true that some original cells came from non-pre-existing cells, but since then it's true that cells only come from other cells. And like I said, that's usually from splitting. last time when I was talking about how many cells you have, I said that you officially started as a zygote, which is a single cell. And then you became two cells big because your zygote splits, and then each of those split your four cells. That's how new cells come about. That's an important part of cell theory. That's usually how things happen as far as new cells being coming onto the scene. But here we see actually a bit of an exception to that, because the zygote that you started out with, which a zygote is a fertilized egg, it's no longer an egg. Officially, it's only an egg before it's fertilized, before the sperm comes along and delivers its DNA. But anyway, what you have here are sperm and egg. Those are sex cells. The unisex term for a sex cell is gamete. So a sperm is a gamete, an egg is a gamete. And fertilization is really the fusion of these two gametes, each of which is a separate cell to begin with, to form a zygote. So instead of one cell splitting into two, you have two cells fusing into one. But notice that shortly after that happens, you have the normal situation of cells splitting into two, and then four, and then eight, and eventually your 100 trillion cells, as I said before. All right. Eight. I almost certainly don't have to tell you, and even if it weren't labeled, that this is DNA. One of the most famous molecules in the world nowadays. Hasn't been all that long that we've known about it. I mean, it's long in terms of your lifetime, but not very long, actually. Fewer than 100 years have we really known anything about this molecule. But it is truly important to life. It is an example, DNA is an example of a very large molecule. Molecules are small from our point of view, but there are small molecules and big molecules when you compare molecules to each other. And big molecules are called macromolecules. Macro meaning big. And all organisms, not only all organisms alive now, all organisms that have existed since the first successful cells that were the ancestors to all organisms that are alive now, all organisms are made up of molecules, but in addition to sort of run-of-the-mill small molecules, all organisms have to be made up of four major categories of macromolecules. And there's an upcoming chapter devoted to surveying those four categories. But since we're looking at one of them right now, I'll just tell you that I'll tell you what those categories are. Talk more about them later. The four categories of macromolecules are nucleic acids, and that's what DNA is an example of. Second category, and there's no order to the categories, but another category is polysaccharides. Another one is polypeptides. And the other is lipids. Okay, so we'll be discussing all four of these. I just wanted to give you the names, especially because I wanted to introduce the phrase nucleic acid, which is what the NA of DNA stands for. DNA overall, as an acronym, stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. And why do you suppose these things were named nucleic acids? Based on the word. Any idea?
Because they're than the nucleus?
Exactly. At least in eukaryotic cells, because only eukaryotic cells have a nucleus, but that's where they were discovered, and so that's why they were named nucleic acids. They're found in the nucleus. But all cells, even prokaryotic cells that don't have a nucleus, require DNA, and for the same reasons. Okay, so even though a prokaryotic cell doesn't have a nucleus, it still has nucleic acids. It's just kind of a misnomer for them. DNA is something that is so important to cell biology that we're going to spend almost the second half of the term studying in one way or another. The last third plus of the term is going to be about DNA in one way or another. But we can see a little bit of its structure here. This is just a tiny fraction of the overall length of this enormously long molecule, which is why it fades out. This isn't the whole thing. But it is a... it's a molecule that has two major functions. Now, I'm sure that you've heard of DNA, so, and you probably have an idea of what DNA does, but what would you say are the two functions of DNA? Anyone want to guess? Yes, replication is one of the two functions. And what does replication mean? It means making a copy. DNA features self-replication. It's a self-replicating molecule, which means that because of the way it's built, and we'll look at why later in a different chapter, because of the way it's built, though, a molecule of DNA, is able to serve as a template for making a copy of itself. And that's one of the major functions of DNA. The reason that is so important is because DNA has to be present in cells for them to continue to live, at least for a while. There are cells in our body that don't have DNA, by the way, our red blood cells. When they develop, they have DNA, but they get rid of it so that they can make room for even more hemoglobin. But because they don't have any DNA, they can't repair themselves, they can't live very long, and red blood cells are dying by the millions in your body every day. You have to replace them continuously. But anyway, cells to be viable, to continue to live, need DNA. All kinds of cells, prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells. And as I was talking about in cell theory, when cells are created, it's because an existing cell splits into two cells. Well, if those two cells are going to be viable, they're both going to require DNA, right? And they're both going to require the entire amount of DNA that the original cell had. So that's why replication is so important. If you split into two and you have to give each of your two daughter cells all of your DNA, then you first need to make an extra copy of it so that each of them can get all of it. That's what replication is all about. And that is the function of DNA that really has to do with the end of one cell's life and the beginning of two new cells' life. But during the lifetime of a cell, the other major function of DNA comes into play. Who wants to guess at what that is? Or does anyone know? The other function is called transcription. And we'll take a close look at transcription later. I just want to introduce the term. Transcription is how DNA is used as sets of instructions. Now, you've heard of genes, I'm sure. Genes are DNA, but one gene is really just a little subset of the overall length of an entirely an entire DNA molecule. So one DNA contains many genes. Each gene, though, is a sequence of these A's, T's, C's, and G's that we'll look at later. And that sequence, that particular sequence, which can be anything, but any given gene has a particular sequence, that sequence, because of the sequence, is information. DNA is an informational molecule. Just like a sequence of numbers that you know is a telephone number is information, right? Every number is different information compared to other numbers. And so a gene is an informational piece of DNA that tells the cell indirectly how to make a polypeptide, which is a different one of the four macromolecules. Proteins are made of they are polypeptides. And a lot of people say that DNA gives us our traits, or gives any organism its traits. But that's really only indirectly true. The traits that an organism has, in other words, how you smell, how you look, everything about you, really, how you can think, how fast you can run, that's all directly a result of the particular polypeptides or proteins that your body can make and has. But even though there's no limit to the number of different proteins that can be produced, any given organism is stuck with only a certain set of proteins that it's able to produce, because a cell can't make a protein unless it's told how to do so. And the DNA is what tells the cell how to build a particular protein. So you inherit DNA. That's what's passed on from cell to cell in reproduction. That's how you got your DNA as the zygote, from a sperm and from an egg. The DNA came from your parents. And you're stuck with that DNA, and that's why you're stuck with some certain set of proteins that gives you your specific traits. And a little bit ago when I mentioned mutation, with respect to natural selection, mutation is just changes in DNA sequence. It's accidental changes in DNA sequence. When that happens, and it's random, that's why it's not a design process, that means some individuals that get this accidentally different DNA will now make different kinds of proteins and therefore have different kinds of traits. Different can be not as good, different can be neutral, different can be even better than what it was. And that's where natural selection comes into play. When mutation happens and creates randomly different individuals, it's the ones that just randomly happen to be better fit to their surroundings that are going to be selected for in natural selection, because they will have a better chance, because of their better proteins, at living long enough to pass their DNA, which tells you how to make those better proteins, on to the next generation. The ones that don't have as good a fitness because of their proteins will not have as high a chance of living as long. And if you die, you don't pass on your DNA. So that's how each generation gets a little bit better fit. And that is the essence of natural selection. Okay, let's switch gears again. Like I said, this chapter's all over the place, but this is slide 9, it looks like. Is that right? Okay, in slide 9, we're looking at schematic representations of two major feedback categories. And feedback is really important when we consider homeostasis. And I don't think I gave you that term last time, did I? Homeostasis itself is really important in biology. I should have given you the term homeostasis when I talked in that opening slide about the fact that organisms regulate. When I talked about regulation, That regulation is a way to maintain what is called homeostasis. The word itself means staying the same. That's not really true, or nothing really stays the same within any cell. It's changing. But there's all kinds of variables in an organism. A variable, of course, is anything that can change value. So there's all kinds of variables, like temperature and pH, for instance. Those are two that are easy to understand, but there's a lot more variables than just those two. The temperature is a particular value at any given moment, right? But it can go up or down. Homeostasis refers to the maintenance of a relatively stable internal environment, not just temperature, but all variables, for within an organism. And that's so important because any given species can tolerate only certain limits for any given variable. If the variable gets outside of that livable range, it's dead. Too hot, using the temperature example, too hot, death. Too cold, death. So that's what regulation is all about. Staying alive by making sure that the variables aren't allowed to wander outside of the allowable range. Now, feedback is involved in homeostasis. It's what leads to homeostasis, but not both of these types. What we see here are the two categories of feedback, but importantly, only one of these can ever lead to homeostasis, specifically negative feedback. Positive feedback is the opposite of negative feedback, and it can never lead to homeostasis. Now, here's why. I need to give you some more definitions to make sense of this. In any given biological process or system that involves feedback, there is variables that I've already defined. But there's also set point. For each variable, there is a set point. Now, the set point is a particular value of a variable, but it's the desired value. And this is why using temperature as an analogy is good, because it's easy for you to understand from experience. A thermostat, like the one on the wall, has a set point that you set, right? That's the desired temperature. That's what you want the room to stay at. The room is never going to stay at that temperature, by the way. It's going to go up and down, just like temperature in the body does, or within a cell even. But anyway, that's what the set point is. The particular value, the correct value in a sense, of a variable. The variable itself, though, at any given moment, can have any value. It's almost never exactly at the set point. Just like the temperature is almost never exactly at what you set the thermostat at. Which means that there's almost always a difference between the current value of the variable and the set point. If there is a difference, which there usually is, because they're not the same, then we call that difference the error. Now notice that an error can be in either of two directions, right? Keeping with the temperature example, you could have an error because the temperature is above set point, too warm. You can also have an error because it's below set point, too cold. Either one is an error. They're in opposite directions. Well, in both cases, negative feedback comes to the rescue. Whether it's an error that's too big or too small, it's negative feedback that you want in both of those cases, not positive feedback. And this, by the way, is why it is called negative feedback. Negative is the adjective of negate. The verb negate means to get rid of or to undo. So it's negative, in a sense, feedback. What is being negated in feedback is the error. So negative feedback operates in such a way that if there is an error, changes are made so that the variable value gets changed back so that it's closer to the set point. In other words, the error gets reduced, it gets negated. And that happens in either direction. If it's too warm in the room, feedback will turn on the AC and it'll come back down. If it gets too cold, feedback, negative feedback, is going to turn on the heater and it's going to go back up. And so it's going to go up and down. It's going to oscillate between the allowable ranges, but that's part of homeostasis. That would be specifically thermostasis, which is just part of homeostasis. Homeostasis involves maintenance of all the variables within tolerable limits, though, not just temperature. Here, negative feedback is schematized with respect to what is called a biochemical pathway, which we'll talk more about later as well. A to B to C to D, those are some sort of substances. Chemical A gets turned into chemical B, which then gets turned into C, and then gets turned into D. The reason the cell would be running this pathway, by the way, is because it needs D. And as long as it needs D, D is not going to start being stockpiled. It's going to be used. But as soon as the cell no longer needs D, D is going to start building up. And that is nice as far as negative feedback is concerned, because D in abundance is going to feed back into the pathway and shut it off so that you don't make any more. That's negative feedback. Positive feedback is exactly the opposite. It never leads to homeostasis because positive feedback always makes the error, whatever it is, even worse. Here, W to X to Y to Z. Z building up is going to cause even more Z to be produced. That can never lead to homeostasis, right? So, since negative feedback is the only feedback mechanism that leads to and maintains homeostasis, negative feedback mechanisms are far more common in organisms than positive feedback mechanisms. Organisms do feature both, but the comparatively rare feedback mechanisms are always temporary because they are not homeostatic. And there are several examples of positive feedback mechanisms, but biology textbooks usually use one involving humans because it's familiar to people, and that is parturition, childbirth. In a pregnant woman, the fetus is growing in the uterus, which is a blind-ended hollow organ containing the fetus. Blind end is at the top. And the cervix, which is the neck of the uterus and is narrow part of it, that's the opening, is below that. And in most cases, it's not always true, but in most cases, the head of the fetus is upside down. So it is at the cervix. Well, when it comes to time for labor, that head is pushing on the cervix, trying to open it up. And that stretching of the cervix gets sensed by the nervous system, sends impulses to the brain, which responds by releasing oxytocin, a hormone, travels through the bloodstream. So the oxytocin reaches the entire body, but the only thing in the body that really listens to that oxytocin signal is the uterus. And it responds to that by squeezing. The uterus is a muscular organ, so it squeezes at the top, at the blind end, where the feet are usually. And that squeezes the fetus farther toward the cervix, which makes it stretch even more, which sends an even stronger message to the brain, which responds by releasing even more oxytocin, which makes the uterus squeeze even more, and so it's just building up. It's getting worse and worse in terms of error. And it's temporary because either the fetus will be popped out and the woman will survive, or because the woman will die. Either way, it's temporary. No positive feedback mechanism can last indefinitely because you can't live without homeostasis. So if everything goes well, as soon as delivery is made, then normal negative feedback mechanisms will take over and restore homeostasis in the woman's body. Ten. The kind of triangular shape that we see here is a way to represent a classification scheme. Classification refers to grouping organisms into neat little boxes, basically. Humans do this, as I was saying before, I think. We've been classifying organisms for a long time, millennia. We've been doing this because humans just want things to be nice and neat. But anyway, the classification schemes have changed drastically over the ages. They started out just, humans said, when they looked at an organism, they said, okay, this is a plant or this is an animal. Those were the two possibilities, plants and animals. We didn't know anything about microscopic life then. And because they grow from the ground, they've lumped fungi in with plants, even though they're closer to us than they are to plants. The point is, we've been doing this different as we've learned things over the ages. But notice the headers here. You've probably heard of almost all of these. Kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. You've probably heard these, right? Those are all examples of taxa. T-A-X-A is the plural of taxon. A taxon is a real general term. It simply means a group. So, order is a taxon, phylum is a taxon, kingdom is a taxon. They're just different sizes. Just like the biological organization is a hierarchy that we talked about, this is a hierarchical arrangement as well. This is a nested arrangement. As we go from left to right on the headers, each taxon to the right is bigger than the one on the left. And so it includes more and more things. And when I first learned this, probably like in seventh grade or something, sixth or seventh grade, there were no longer just two kingdoms that would, like, so we started with plants and animals, and that's it. By then, there were five kingdoms. But kingdoms were still the biggest taxa. Well, nowadays, which isn't all that much longer, there's many more than five kingdoms. Plus, kingdoms are no longer the biggest taxa, as you can see on the top here. An even bigger group than a kingdom is a domain. And domains are the biggest, most inclusive taxa. So each domain contains a certain number of kingdoms, each kingdom contains a certain number of phyla, and so on. The most specific, which is what that literally means, is species. And this brings up also the notion of binomial nomenclature. Nomenclature simply means naming things. Nomen means name. Binomial means two names. Binomial nomenclature is using the so-called scientific name for a species or for an organism, like this American black bear. The scientific name is Ursus americanus. But really, it's two names, That's the binomial part of the phrase. And binomial, we can just call it a binomial. The scientific name is a binomial. But the binomial is really just the name for genus, the genus that the organism belongs to, which is one group, followed by the name of the species within that genus that that same organism belongs to. All right? Now, notice that this is italicized. The proper way to write a binomial is that the genus name, well, the entire binomial is italicized. The genus name is always capitalized, and that tells us that it's the bigger group. The species name is never capitalized. It tells us that it's the smaller group within that genus. So Ursus, just by itself, that's the genus that that bear belongs to. Animals is the kingdom to which it belongs. They're just different size groups. If you want to use the human example, we belong to a genus called Homo. Now, there were other members of Homo, other species. We're the only ones that survived. All the others have gone extinct, but there were more. And our species is called sapiens, which is not a plural. There's no such word as sapien. Sapiens is the singular. Okay? But anyway, that's why the binomial for humans is Homo sapiens. Our species is not Homo sapiens, sapiens. Our species is sapiens. But our genus species is Homo sapiens. Okay, in 11, we can talk more about domains. I've just got done telling you that domains are the biggest taxa. Now we can see that there are exactly three domains that we recognize. And you can see their names here, bacteria, archaea, and eukarya. Now think back to the dichotomy of cell types that we just talked about. It's a dichotomy, right? There's two types of cells, prokaryotic and eukaryotic. There's three domains, though. One of those domains is called eukarya because that domain includes all of the eukaryotic organisms of the world, now and ever. All that have ever existed, including us, of course, as animals. Not only does eukarya include all eukaryotes, that's all it includes. But it's just one of three domains. There's a dichotomy of cell type, but notice that there is no domain called prokarya. If an organism is not eukaryotic, then it's not in eukarya. But then that means that there's two possibilities because there are two other domains. So the prokaryotes of the world are divided into two domains. Any given individual prokaryote is either in domain bacteria or in domain archaea. And it's pretty easy to guess that the domain bacteria includes the bacteria of the world. Bacteria are prokaryotic organisms. They are not all of the prokaryotic organisms, though. They are most of them, actually. But they are not all of them. Archaeans, which are members of archaea, which means old, by the way, like in archaeology. Archaeans are also prokaryotic organisms. And they would look very similar to you under a light microscope if you were to compare it with a bacterium. But there's really important molecular differences, which is why we justify putting them in their own domains. Bacteria, by the way, are by far the most successful organisms in history. That's always been true, and it likely always will be true. They were, you know, the first successful cells that are the ancestors to all cells, they became the bacteria. There were some branches off the, off along the way that, that formed the other domains, including our own domain. But bacteria have never disappeared. They we tend to not think about them because we don't see them. They're invisible to our eyes. But they're everywhere that we have found life. So they're not only successful in the fact that they thrive everywhere that it's possible to live, but they're also just in sheer numbers overwhelmingly abundant. The number of bacteria just alive right now is enormous compared to all other organisms that have ever existed combined. And in terms of your own body, we've mentioned the fact that it's roughly 100 trillion cells making you up. Well, those are the cells that you can claim as your own because they have your DNA. But the thing that you call your body, that three-dimensional space, is really outnumbered by bacteria. For every one of your own 100 trillion cells, there's between 10 and 100 bacteria living in and on you. And that doesn't include all the bacteria everywhere else in the world. So they are enormously successful organisms. We just tend not to think about them day to day. Those are the three domains, though. Brings us to 13. All right, no, that's a 12, isn't it? The cartoons here in pink and blue are representations of cilia, which is a plural word. Cilium is the singular, which means hair. Now, real hair is something that only us mammals make. So it's really not a hair, but it looks hairy to us. That's why it was called that. A cilium, though, is a cellular projection from the surface. And so the plasma membrane of the cell is actually covering it. It comes outward. But a cilium is a locomotory device, which means it functions for locomotion, which is movement from one place to another. And the point being made by the slide here is that this was an early, something that evolved early on in life history and was so successful by natural selection that it has remained pretty much unchanged. So we're taking a cilium from each of two organisms that, of course, they're related if you go back far enough. All organisms are related because there's one successful lineage of cells, the trunk of the tree of life that gave rise throughout 4 billion years to all organisms that have ever existed. But a paramecium here is a protist, microscopic eukaryote. And the blue one is from a windpipe of a human. So yes, we are related, all organisms are, but not very recently related. Right? Humans and microscopic paramecia are quite a bit different. But when you compare the molecular architecture in the cross-section of their cilia, they're almost identical. Because that particular accident that gave rise to cilia was so successful by natural selection that any further change to it would be selected against. I mean, it's really hard to improve on something that works so well, is the point here. Okay, but the fact that these two pretty drastically different organisms share almost the exact molecular structure for their cilia is just one of several bits of information that point to the fact that we all organisms do have a common ancestor. We're all related by those first successful cells, to those first successful cells. All right, now 13. I've been talking about natural selection. Now let's actually look at a cartoon example of it to make it more sense if it doesn't already make sense to you. We're looking at two species here, two populations, a prey and a predator population. The prey are the insects. The predator is the bird. The predator is interested in eating the prey. That's what predators do, obviously. And the black background here represents the substrate or the surface on which these insects live. Now, in nature, it wouldn't be a pure, even black background, but it is just for simplicity shown that way here. They live on dark surroundings, though, is the point here. This population does, at least. And because differences in DNA, which individuals have, lead to differences in the proteins that they can make, which causes different traits, like I was saying before, that means that within any natural population, there is variation within that population for any given characteristic, like the characteristic of the color of these insects, for example. Some of them were given DNA that makes them darker. Some of them were given DNA that makes them lighter. Just depends on what their parents gave them as DNA. All right, so they're just going about their business eating whatever they eat. The predator, the bird, does not care at all what color these insects are. It doesn't prefer the taste of one or the other. It just wants to eat. And to be successful as a predator, it wants to not spend very much time getting fed. Because the more energy it wastes trying to find food, the more likely it is to starve and therefore be dead. Okay? So in other words, the predator is simply looking for any insect it can snap at. And that's going to be easiest. It's going to be easiest for the bird to see the insects that have the highest contrast with their surroundings. In this case, the lighter colored ones. So in this particular set of conditions, lightness is the color, or is the trait that the genetically unlucky individuals in the population have. Right? It makes them much more susceptible to being eaten. And what happens when you get eaten by the bird? You no longer are able to reproduce. You're dead. You have the DNA that codes for light color, but you can't pass it on to anything if you're dead. If you have the darker colored coding DNA, then you might get eaten also randomly, but you have a much better chance of eluding depredation, being eaten. So that means you have a better chance of passing on the version of DNA that codes for darkness. And that's why in the next generation of the population, a greater fraction of the population will be made up of darker individuals than light individuals. And as a whole, the population will therefore be better adapted to this particular set of conditions in which they live. That's the essence of natural selection. It gets better and better. Now, there's all kinds of real examples. This is a cartoon example, but it's actually very similar to a famous real example in England 100 years or so ago, involving moths. There were moths that lived. It's just the opposite with respect to darkness and lightness, though. These moths could randomly be either darker gray or lighter gray. But for thousands of years, they live on tree bark. I mean, they spent a lot of time on tree bark. And for thousands of years, the tree bark was light-colored. So that meant that by natural selection, it was better to be light-colored. The dark-colored ones would stand out, and those are the ones that got eaten. But then the Industrial Revolution came along. We started burning a bunch of stuff. Early 1800s. Late 1700s, early 1800s. That's where all the pollution started building up. And there was so much soot in the air at the time that the bark actually got dark. And so what was successful for all that time now all of a sudden is not successful. Environments, real environments change. And when they do, the selection pressures, as we say, change. So now all of a sudden it's beneficial to be dark. The ones that were getting, to be dark. The ones that were getting eaten are now the ones that are surviving, and they noticed right away the next generations became more and more dark. Natural selection worked in the opposite direction, but still working. A 14 is a tree-like arrangement, as you see here, like a family tree for humans. Same thing. It is another slide that has to do with classification. But classification, as I said before, has happened a lot of different ways. For most of human history, we classified things based just on how they looked to us. That was the only thing that was important. For instance, we would lump a bat and a bird together because they both fly. Well, that's not what's happening here. This specific kind of classification is called taxonomy. And taxonomy has to do with, taxonomy is classification based on shared ancestry. So it has nothing to do with how things look to humans. It has to do with how closely they are related ancestrally. It's all about natural selection and passing on information, genetic information from one generation to another. And so we have these tree-like structures, which are called phylogenetic trees. And this is itself a tree, a phylogenetic tree. But this is just a tiny fraction of the overall tree. There is one huge phylogenetic tree for all of biology. And that one trunk, this is not the trunk, this is just a branch of the huge tree. The trunk of the one overall tree would be that lineage of initially successful cells that came on the scene in early Earth's history. And that has given rise to, as descendants, all organisms, not just these finches. This is just one little piece of the tree. We're in a different piece of the tree, but you go back to the trunk, that's the universality of life. And that's why you have those cilia that I was talking about in really drastically unrelated organisms, similar structures, because we are related when you go back far enough. All right. I'll leave this slide. I don't want to squeeze it into 30 seconds. I wanted to get done with it because it's the last slide, but that's okay. We'll finish it later.